Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, award-winning author and Emmy-nominated documentary producer Stephen C. Smith talks about his latest book, Hitchcock and Herman, the friendship and film scores that changed cinema. This slice-of-life biography of legendary filmmaker Alfred Hitchcock and celebrated composer Bernard Herman was published by Oxford University Press in October 2025. In May of this year, via Zoom, I interviewed Stephen Smith and started by asking him what in his background prepared him to write about these two artistic giants.
Well, I will make a long story very short, Sonia, by saying that I was in the right place at the right time. My parents were children of the Depression who introduced me to classic films, and I have a brother who became a Broadway performer who is 17 years older than I am and already knew a number of people in show business, which sort of perplexed our lawyer father and housemaker mother to have two children go into the directions they did. But I was very fortunate in being surrounded by people in the film industry as someone growing up in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And when I got to USC in the early 1980s, I was resisting a career in law, which I'm sure what my parents had wanted. And I was fascinated by my brother's work in show business. And we had he had a good friend who became a good friend of mine, a gentleman named Robert Osborne, who about 20 years later, after I met him, became the host of Turner Classic Movies.
Indeed, exactly.
The face of the network. And Bob mentored me from the age of 9. He'd invite me over to his place for Hollywood parties with all the famous stars that he would later interview on TCM all those years later. My brother would drive me to the Woodland Hills retirement home for actors. So with a little tape recorder at age 9, I would interview silent film actors and early talkie performers. So I felt very connected to that era and fascinated by the beginning of film, the beginning of sound film, and all the fact that this art form of film evolved so quickly as it did. Anyway, flash forward, when I was 19 years old in college trying to figure out a path, I was both a musician who studied piano since I was 5 years old. I was fascinated with film and taking every film class I could do at USC while trying to figure things out. And I happened to mention to my visiting brother one day, you know, Bernard Herrmann seems like such a fascinating person. His first film score was for Citizen Kane. His right. last was for Taxi Driver. And in between are the years with Alfred Hitchcock and Jane Eyre and The Day the Earth Stood Still. And apparently he was this colorful, temperamental, volatile person who was also a genius. And boy, I'm surprised there isn't a book about him, to which my brother said the words that changed my life. Well, why don't you write one? And when you're 19 years old and you don't know what you don't know and can't do, I thought, well, at the very least, I can interview some people about Bernard Herrmann, since no fewer than 3 professors at USC were former friends of the late Bernard Herrmann. And I thought, perhaps I can assemble a book of question and answer chapters with these interesting people. Well, over 8 years, that evolved into a biography. It was successful and is still in print. A documentary was made about Herrmann at the same time. And since they didn't have a book, they made me their consultant. And that film was nominated for an Oscar. And I was off and running on what became primarily a career of making television network documentaries and now independent feature documentaries. And then lo, all these years later, when I'm a long way from 19 years old and was in my late 50s, I decided to revisit a very particular corner of that world and focus on Benny and Hitch, as they called each other.
Right. And they had an 11-year friendship, right?
They did. It's remarkable. Hitchcock, who was very careful about who he let into his closest inner circle, how quickly he took this temperamental man from New York City with a somewhat braying voice and confrontational manner, how this director from London, who was very conflict averse, who outwardly seemed very calm, but inwardly was sort of roiling with anxieties that are reflected in the movies that Hitchcock made, how he and Benny, who were this kind of classic odd couple personality-wise, how much they bonded, because I think they sort of had the same soul. They both had the same view of life is filled with beauty and also tragedy, and also, perhaps fundamentally for Hitchcock, constant danger. I think the thing that frightened Hitchcock the most was loss of control and life's uncertainty, which we certainly are still feeling these days, and I think is one reason why his films hold up for audiences in the main today. And Herman was also incredibly sensitive. He had an extraordinary ability to put into music what people were feeling and thinking. I sort of say he was the master of writing character psychology into music. So it was a perfect pairing, really. And I think when they realized how much they saw the arts the same way, and they were very, very serious about their work, Hitchcock may have seemed like an entertainer, starting to host his TV show around the same time as he started working with Herman, but he was also a very, very serious filmmaker. But he was an artist businessman, and Benny was an artist first and foremost. And by that, I mean that Hitchcock was very happy to have someone write a hit song for one of his films. And of course, was always keeping an eye on the audience, but managed to make the films he wanted to. And Herman was an artist, certainly a businessman when it came to keeping his price high, but he really took umbrage with anyone who was trying to make commercial shortcuts. He didn't think Hitchcock did that. And so they were a wonderful partnership. They understood each other so well.
Given that the subtitle of your book indicates that this is a friendship between these two men, yes, that changed cinema. So explain that. How do you justify that rather bold statement?
It is a bold statement. And I deliberately didn't write in the subtitle, The Film Scores and Friendship, because I wanted to communicate that this is a book for a general reader, to invite them into a world that I know a lot of people find intimidating, which is to say music, writing about music, reading about music. And what I've done in all three of my books, my first biography of Bernard Herrmann, a book on Max Steiner, and then now Hitchcock and Herrmann, I wanted to invite people who know nothing about music, who've never had a musical lesson in their lives, to try to understand what it was that made Herrmann so special, how he translated his insight into music into something that worked for people, and how to explain it to them.
And I wanted to piggyback on that because you do a really good job. I mean, it's hard to write about music in general, but it's even harder to write about it for people who are not musicians. So how did you figure out, how do I write so that someone who is not a musician can get this and do it in a concise way?
Exactly. Well, the first thing I did was rewatch everything I could see of the late Leonard Bernstein, because he was not only a great symphony conductor, he's the composer of West Side Story. He wrote the film score for On the Waterfront, and he used to host television programs, sometimes for adults, sometimes they were young persons.
But right.
Yeah, but even the young people ones were good for older people, too. He had this incredible knack about making music just sound as ordinary as talking about a friend of yours or someone famous that we all know. And it showed me that there is a path to doing that. And of course, finding metaphors and similes and taking words. There are a lot of words in the musical vocabulary that are taken from Italian, like allegro and feroce and all of that. And people can be intimidated by those words. And if you simply say a few times that simply means fast or ferociously, or what, or if the phrase is a little more complex, or to choose another example, in the score for Vertigo, Herman wanted to create a somewhat supernatural sound in the strings. So he had the violinists have their fingers very high on the fingerboard. So if you can create the image for an audience of a violinist holding that and their fingers moving high on it, then you can explain that Herman would write on the score sur la touche. And that simply means close to the fingerboards. And then you explain that the reason they're close to the fingerboards is it creates a rather ghostly sound. And you try to, or I would try to find a simile, an analogy to a sound that we commonly know. So people would say, oh, I understand what that sound means. So if you could follow me through that path, which is easier to read than perhaps it is for me to explain now, I think there are ways to take things that might sound intimidating, like sur la touche, what are you talking about? And sort of help them. It certainly doesn't hurt that I'm writing about movies like Psycho and Vertigo and North by Northwest that the reader may be familiar with, may know well. And I mentioned it, I think, twice in the book that all of the music can be heard online, that if one goes to the internet, all of that music has been posted by various people. So you can put in those titles and hear it. And since the book's publication, I created a Spotify list also to help give a very, if you will, curated tour of the most important music for it.
Okay, well, I think you did a good job.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, how did these two men meet and start their collaboration?
That's a good question. Well, I was fascinated by the fact, as I was when I wrote my first book on Bernard Herrmann, which looked at the totality of his life, which extended far beyond movies and Alfred Hitchcock, in writing just about these two men and the 11-year partnership they had. I was always fascinated by the fact that they met in the early 40s, but they didn't work together till the mid-1950s. And it's always fun when a famous partnership happens, when you see those almost times of them coming together. Hitchcock had been a successful director in his native Britain, and a very powerful independent film producer named David O. Selznick brought Hitchcock over to America just before World War II, coincidentally. Mm-hmm. And Hitchcock was very happy working in the Hollywood system and stayed here, but he did not have the power that he would later have. That is to say, he worked as an employee of David O. Selznick, which was somewhat frustrating for him. So Selznick would make the choices of who wrote the music and where the music would be and all of that. It was only after a number of years, in 1953, about 14 years after he came to Hollywood, that his agent made him what may have been the greatest movie deal a director ever had up to that time. Paramount Pictures, which, like everyone, was fighting television that was keeping people at home and their filmmakers in-house were going away. Well, they wanted Alfred Hitchcock, and they gave him basically everything. And that's where my book begins, with this watershed moment in Hitchcock's life when Paramount says, you can make whatever movie you want as long as it's under this very high budget ceiling. You can have a percentage of the gross. You can own some of these films outright after 8 years. They gave him just this extraordinary deal. And Hitchcock came through for them by making many of his greatest films, starting with Rear Window. That was right before he worked with Herrmann, but then going on this incredible run that included, in a row, Vertigo, North by Northwest, Psycho, The Birds, and producing for 10 years his television series. And one fun thing to write about in the book was that Herrmann scored 17 episodes of the Hitchcock series. For those who love the combination of Alfred Hitchcock and Bernard Herrmann, I wanted to make people aware that there were 17 more terrific scores to hear. So I think Hitchcock felt so creatively empowered that he finally had the chance to work with Bernard Herrmann in a way where there would be no one else getting in the way, like a Selznick. Hitchcock was his own producer. And the wonderful thing was they started on a film that's not their best known today, a quirky little dark comedy called The Trouble with Harry, Shirley MacLaine's first movie, about this dead body that's lying on a hill in beautiful Vermont that keeps popping up in inappropriate places. And Herrmann took this movie that kind of had an odd tone mixing, as I say, sort of dark comedy and romance and the beauty of the location work. And he wrote the perfect Hitchcockian score. And unlike anyone who had ever scored a Hitchcock movie before, he put the character of Alfred Hitchcock in the music with these kind of low bassoons and low brass sounds that the character that television viewers were just about to meet at home on his television series, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Herrmann really put that into the score. And as soon as Hitchcock heard it, he was chuckling at the musical session. He was so delighted. And I think he realized, this person gets me. He knows what my movies are. He knows who I am. And they'd had a few lunches together socially before. So they had met. They were, you know, friendly, but they became almost like creative brothers in a moment. So much so that Hitchcock was already developing his next film. It's called The Man Who Knew Too Much with Jimmy Stewart and Doris Day. And it involves a huge set piece filmed in London at the Albert Hall, where an assassination of a politician is supposed to take place during a concert. Well, Hitchcock loved the score so much that he instructed his screenwriter to put Bernard Herrmann into the movie script. So not only would Herrmann be writing the underscore, he plays himself, Bernard Herrmann, we see on posters, as the conductor of the London Symphony in the key sequence of the film. So Benny was given what was probably the best movie cameo of all time. He's really the centerpiece of this famous sequence. So that tells you how quickly they bonded.
Right. And it's also interesting that Hitchcock is known for making cameo appearances in his
films.
Oh, did he also make any cameo appearances in the TV series that he
That's a
produced?
good question. Yes, Hitchcock never made a cameo appearance, I think, because we always saw him hosting, giving the intro and the outro. And when it became an hour series, popping up in the middle and making mildly disparaging remarks about the sponsors, which was then very shocking. And it got some of the advertisers angry until they realized that people remembered the product twice as much as when Alfred Hitchcock made a disparaging remark about taking a break for the advertising. But that's another story.
I remember in the 60s, I watched Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and it really was always kind of comical. One, the music drew you in, and then his good evening,
Yes, his
took
persona.
you into whatever that particular episode was about. So it's pretty
Exactly.
interesting. Now, you don't shy away from writing about these men's egos, their insecurities, and even some evidence of self-sabotage. So I wanted to know what archival and interview sources you use to really kind of flesh out their personalities.
Well, I will really try to make this short, Sonia, because it's 42 years of my life. Going back to that 19-year-old, I was very fortunate in writing my first book, The Biography of Herman, to discover that while his musical scores, the things he wrote by hand, had already been sent where he wanted them to go at the University, UC Santa Barbara, but Benny's widow, Norma, still had many of his personal possessions in her home in the UK. So I arranged to do part of my college studies in Britain. After connecting with her and Norma, who I just saw weeks ago, is still a dear, dear friend. And boy, was she kind to a young American, because she and her second husband basically let me move into their home on the weekends and go through these seemingly infinite number of boxes that contained Herman's papers. So I would open it up and find letters from Hitchcock, letters from Truffaut, from Orson Welles, from Stravinsky, and because he had a concert life as well. He wrote concert music and conducted concerts. So it was really extraordinary that before anyone had really seen them since his death 8 years before, I had access to his papers. And I retained copies of all of those, thinking that maybe someday they would come in handy. And then when that first book was published in 1991, not everyone knew who Bernard Herrmann was. Mostly people in the industry did. And certainly if you imitated the shower music from Psycho, they'd say, oh, right, I've heard that.
And also, I think
Yeah.
if you were a fan of Orson Welles's
War of the Worlds broadcast on
War of
radio,
the Worlds,
Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane,
Exactly,
because
yeah.
if you are obviously, if you watch Citizen Kane and you knew that the music played an important role in
Very,
that film
yes,
too. So,
exactly. But what was really fun was that by the 2000s, I remember watching a press junket I was doing, and Johnny Depp was talking about Sweeney Todd, and he was talking about the Bernard Herrmann influence on that film and the composer of that music, Stephen Sondheim, who wrote Herrmann a fan letter when he was 15 and got a reply. Sondheim told me and was saying more and more as his life went on, that Bernard Herrmann was the inspiration for Sweeney Todd, and he based the whole score on what he called his Bernard Herrmann chord. And the Simpsons were doing parodies of Hitchcock movies using the Herrmann music. And the television producer Ryan Murphy is constantly using music from the Hitchcock Herrmann films. The 2011 Best Picture winner, The Artist, used about 6 minutes of Vertigo's music in it. Herrmann's music had become ringtones on phones. Lady Gaga used the main title of Vertigo for the first 2.5 minutes of a music video. So from pop divas to advertising to parodies, Bernard Herrmann was everywhere, and so much more material, so many more private papers were coming out and recording sessions. I got to hear virtually all of the full recording sessions of the Hitchcock Herrmann sessions, where we hear Herrmann speaking to the orchestra. And so I thought, what if I could create a book that takes just 11 years? Because I think we're both familiar with biographies that are cradle to grave, and I did one of those, but I also love biographies that focus on a very particular time period. What if I took a book that starts when they connected, which is when the studio system of old is starting to fall apart in Hollywood, the old system of everyone's under contract and it's now everybody's on their own? That's where it begins. What if we stood over their shoulders very closely and listened to them? And by the time the collaboration's over, it's 1966, and we're 1 year away from Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate, and 2 years away from Easy Rider. Everything's blown up. It's Sgt. Pepper and the Beatles, and the whole world has changed behind them. What kept them close? In what ways did Hitchcock rely on Herrmann beyond what any filmmaker, I would argue, had done up to then? By creating entire reels of film, as they would say in those days, about 12 minutes of a movie, no dialogue virtually, just music, which Hitchcock hadn't even heard yet. He wouldn't hear it until it was recorded. You know, how did that relationship come about? And then how did the world that was changing subtly behind them through the whole story bring us to the last chapter? So I thought that would be a fun challenge, and to constantly flash backwards to give us a little bit of biography so we understand who this incredibly complicated and colorful person of Bernard Herrmann is. Absolutely. And hopefully get insights into Alfred Hitchcock, who we may think we know about, but there are surprises, and then constantly flash forward so that during the Vertigo chapter, we'll hear about why Lady Gaga used that music and why the artist used that music and the main title of Psycho, how that influenced the Beatles when they were writing Eleanor Rigby, you know, so things like that. So it was a fun exercise in trying to create a very propulsive, dynamic narrative that also did some interesting jumps in time.
Excellent. Now, you talked a lot about your access to Herrmann archival yes. material. What about for Hitchcock?
Well, I was also extremely lucky on the Hitchcock front, Sonia, because his daughter, Pat, who really became the family spokesperson after Hitchcock's death, and Hitchcock's wife, Alma, who was absolutely his closest private collaborator. I don't think a script page or an edit of a film was signed off on until Alma gave her approval. Pat was a wonderfully kind, warm, and generous person, and she left the majority of Hitchcock's papers to the Margaret Herrick Library, the Academy Library in Los Angeles. And while they were starting to come in the 80s when I wrote my first book, and I had access to a lot of them, and I really started this book in, let's see, 2022, by then all the family papers had sort of been vetted, and there were many, many more papers, and other people who worked with Hitchcock had left their papers. So I found much more correspondence to and from Bernard Herrmann, and I found notes taken at the very last session that they ever worked on together that were rather revelatory to me, and I could use them. So on the Hitchcock front, it was almost one-stop shopping in that the papers were there, and also there have been so many fine Hitchcock scholars that had gone through that material that they gave me a head start in collections to explore, let's say.
Great. There are a lot of photos sprinkled throughout the book in various settings, you know, maybe in the studio, on a set, at home, with family. How did you, you know, get access to these photos?
Thank you for mentioning that, because I really wanted, as we all do, I think, when we write a book, but it's nice to have some visual elements to them. Once again, I have to give a lot of credit to all three of Benny's wives. I had spent a lot of time writing my first book with his three wives. His first, Lucille Fletcher, was herself a successful writer who wrote a famous radio play that became a famous suspense movie called Sorry, Wrong Number. And Lucille was a wonderful person. They had two children. So Lucille gave me many photos. Their daughter, Taffy, who remains a friend, her real name is Dorothy, who is a biographer, by the way. She gave me many precious family photos. And then all of Benny's photos, since he died very suddenly in 1975, all of his photos, the majority, were still with his widow, Norma. So I had access to them. And the Hitchcock photos, I again went to the Margaret Herrick Library, and they have many behind the scenes photos. And that's where I found photos that had never been published before of Benny and Hitch together. So that was a real goal for me, was not just to put in the pictures that everyone, if you're a buff, that you know certain pictures, but to not just go to the greatest hits, but show things that I thought really gave an insight into the two men and their relationship and their private lives. And given that Herrmann could be a tempestuous person, in both of my books, I wanted the reader to see behind that challenging side of the man, let's say, and they both had their challenges, to see that each of them was a very, very vulnerable human being, as we all are fundamentally, you know, and to show those sides and to show that their greatest strength, their superpower, was inside that vulnerability. In other words, their fears, their passions were what they brought to film and music respectively, and then brought together. And it was those same qualities that could be, you know, as we, our greatest strengths can be our greatest weaknesses. You know, Benny's passion could in friendships and professional relationships, you know, he's such a fascinating, contradictory character. On a good night, he would have been one of the best evenings of conversation you would ever have. He knew British and Russian literature. He knew music going back to the 16th century. He knew art. I mean, he loved life and loved creativity. But then there was, as one of his close friends said, an eyedropper of paranoia in him. And I think the eyedropper got more full as time went on, perhaps, and times exactly. changed and he fell out of fashion. But that's something I'll leave the reader to explore.
What was your writing process like? I mean, how did writing this book compare to your work as a writer-producer for documentaries?
Well, when I was 19 and wrote the biography, I was really figuring it out as I went along. And it's a miracle that it turned out as well as it apparently did. It's still in print and I've had nice responses to it. But I was still in my 20s when I wrote it. And let's face it, I didn't have much life experience. So fortunately, I kept everything and kept collecting over the years. And after the book came out, people close to him told me more things about him that they'd forgotten, or his wives could tell me even more stories that they wanted to share with me over time. And when I came to writing my new book, which happened about in 2022, I believe, I decided not to look at all at my original book, to just try to leave that on the shelf. Unless I just couldn't find something and I knew it was in there, I put that away. And I read all the interview transcripts. I listened to the audio cassettes that were falling apart from the 80s. And I have to tell you, Sonia, it was as if those people long gone were talking to me as an adult, because I understood in many cases what they were saying in a way that I just couldn't have had without the experience. I've been married twice, so having been through a divorce, I listened to Lucille Fletcher talking about the very painful divorce when Benny mm-hmm. fell in love with her cousin and married her cousin. Mm-hmm. And hearing Lucille's voice talking to me, I know it sounds silly, but I felt like she was speaking to me as this adult person now, and I could understand her on a deeper level. Also with Hitchcock, looking back, the 20-year-old in me, we're all a little more rebellious, perhaps, and a little anti-establishment when we're young. I was probably a little more on Team Herman than Team Hitchcock, let's say. So that when there is a big disagreement between the two of them, I tended to think, well, Herman was a genius and, you know, he was more right. And I think Hitchcock was wrong. Well, not that the book was written in that kind of black and white way, but I'm just looking back at myself and speaking candidly that I was kind of going with the rebel in my mind, my subconscious. Since then, I've had the good fortune to produce over 200 television documentaries, and I've been a producer whose time was running out, whose money was running out, who'd hired a composer, asked for certain things that were important, and heard something radically different and felt profound disappointment and frustration, you know, and so I wanted this book to have no heroes and no villains. And what this story ultimately is, I think it's a very tragic one on the friendship front, right? Because it's a story of two men who loved each other and wanted the same thing and ultimately were at odds. And that's why it ends a certain way. But I really wanted to have compassion for Hitchcock and Herman and the studios that they worked with, while at the same time, as you say, not glossing over their weaknesses as human beings, as we all have.
Right. Did you have any difficulties finding a publisher for this book? And what was the turnaround time between, say, when you came up with the book proposal and then publication?
Well, I was very fortunate on this book. I may never be able to say this again, but as soon as I sent Hitchcock and Herman to Oxford University Press, with whom I had such a good collaboration on the Max Steiner book, they said, great. And I actually pushed the deadline forward a little bit, as I recall. I wanted to get the book out by October of 2025. That was the 65th anniversary of Psycho. And it's the centenary of Hitchcock directing his first film. So even if no one else cared about those things, I thought it would be a good time to get the book out. So I've been very fortunate in getting that done. And it certainly I was fortunate in having so many older interviews and thousands of pieces of paper already to go through research-wise, but I interviewed every living person that I could find who was still with us, who knew Bernard Herman. And I started the book with as much drama as I could in the prelude by starting it on the last night of his life, which was the final recording session for the film Taxi Driver, which had some interesting Hitchcockian connections. And I interviewed many people who were there with Herman on the last night of his life, and I learned a lot of interesting things from that.
Did you have an agent? Because Oxford University is kind of a hybrid press.
Yes, I'm very glad you asked about my agent, because it lets me say a posthumous thank you again to the great Georges Borchard, who was my agent. My colleague Gary Giddens, author of many fine biographies, Bing Crosby, Louis Armstrong. He was kind enough to ask me to write the Max Steiner book for a series he was overseeing at Oxford. And when I said that I was between agents at the moment, he said, well, let me talk to Georges. George. And then he said, George Borchardt. And I thought, that name's familiar. And I looked him up. And this is someone who escaped Nazi-occupied France, came to America in the 50s. He was the agent for Samuel Beckett. He sold Waiting for Godot. So again, sort of like Hitchcock and Herman, I sort of got a window into the 20th century from a wonderful perspective with the great gentleman, Georges Borchardt, who passed away just a few months ago in his 90s.
Wow. Any recommendations for writers who are at the beginning stages of writing either a dual biography or a biography about a famous artist?
Yes. First, to write about a famous artist, do not give up. A colleague of mine was writing a book on someone who had deterred biographers for decades. And I told him what one of my documentary bosses told me and always prove the case. Do not stop. Keep interviewing people. There will be people who won't ask you if it's authorized or if that person's cooperating. And, you know, if there are threats, ignore them. And 2/3 of the way through the process, reapproach and say, I'm almost done. I've got done all these wonderful interviews. And if you'd love to contribute to this. So if it's a living person, do not be deterred. Keep going and then give them a chance to contribute at the end. And as with my colleague, that's exactly what happened. On the subject of dual biographies, this was another fun challenge of writing this book because I hadn't done that before. I had made a documentary on the Fonda family of actors, Henry and all of that. But there I had a sort of linear structure so that lives could overlap, but I was basically telling it in a chronological way. In this case, I would say know what your story is before you write. Work out the chapters carefully and ask yourself why it's a dual biography. Because if you can answer that question, the answers will fall into place. For me, it was deciding to start with that momentous occasion for Hitchcock having the deal that allowed him to work with Bernard Herrmann. And the ending, for the most part, although there's an epilogue, comes with the end of that relationship. So I would say identify almost like writing, some people do with screenplays and with books, doing whether it's notes on a board or just making notes, make a list of the key intersections of those people's lives. And that might help you find the structure if it isn't an obviously linear one.
Well, thank you so much, Stephen. This has been fantastic.
Oh, Sonia, it's an honor to speak with you. And I can't say enough about how much bio has meant to me over the last several years in giving me inspiration. So thank you for your time.
That was documentary producer and author Stephen C. Smith speaking with me about his latest book, Hitchcock and Herrmann, The Friendship and Film Scores That Changed Cinema. It was published by Oxford University Press in October 2025, and this interview was recorded via Zoom in May of this year. To learn more about bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellian Marie Fillengaines created our theme music. Jenny Skoog is our producer. Carolyn Van Putten, assistant producer. And Shereen Newman is our engineer. I'm executive producer Sonia Williams. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.